Well, we're rather fortunate, really, to be discussing the ideas of Leon Trotsky and permanent revolution in probably the most significant, or a time when his ideas are the most significant in the world for the last couple of decades. And I can guarantee you, actually, this is the first time we've had a Marxism conference where permanent revolution is applied so readily to the world around us. So that's a first. Now, I think to start off a bit, I guess, about the struggle in Egypt, because the revolutionary struggle in Egypt, I think, clearly highlights the importance of revolutionary theory. So even though after Mubarak has been overthrown, we're still seeing that, demands risen by the working class, and we're seeing a divergence in the classes of the revolution. On the one hand, we're seeing the working class continue to raise their own interests as a working class. We're seeing a massive strike wave all throughout Egypt. And on the other hand, we're seeing signs of a more conservatizing influence coming from the middle class, who preach moderation and collaboration with the regime, certain sections of them anyway. And particularly, I think it's quite important seeing sort of the depth of the working class strikes in Egypt at the moment. That's in just over the last 2 weeks, there's been 2,300 on strike in Military Factory 200, just north of Cairo. There's been 7,000 workers in the Suez Canal Authority going on strike, and 20,000 weaving workers in Mahalla on strike. And on top of that, a 35-day sit-in has been carried out in a clothing factory just outside of Cairo, demanding the nationalisation of their industry and the sacking of old managers who were involved with Mubarak's party. The Egyptian trade, there's been an independent Egyptian trade union founded, which has been raising a whole series of demands going beyond just the question of democratic rights in Egypt, but raising a whole series of demands in the interests of the working class, ranging from raises to wages and unemployment benefits, the freedom to organise, job security, the right to strike, nationalisation of privatised industry, price controls, healthcare, and the dissolution of the state-run union. So Trotsky's ideas of permanent revolution, I think, we can see the relevance of them in Egypt today, because Trotsky's theory raised the prospect of how not only the democratic demands of a revolution can be achieved most consistently, but also the potential for the working class to push forward and develop the democratic revolution into a revolution for socialism, and the potential for the working class to take power. And the theory of permanent revolution is possibly one of the most valuable contributions to Marxist theory to date. Leon Trotsky developed the theory of permanent revolution upon reflection of his experience in the revolutionary upheavals in Russia in 1905. While being held in prison in 1906, Trotsky penned Results and Prospects, which was one of the first documents where he articulated the ideas of permanent revolution. And he formulated the necessity for uninterrupted revolutionary struggle for workers' power in Russia. Now, this was a decisive break with the prevailing orthodoxy in the socialist movement of the time. So to fully understand the relevance of permanent revolution and the need for it, we have to delve a little bit into the debates of the time within the socialist movement. So at the turn of the century, the established thought amongst socialist organisations was that it was only possible to achieve socialism, for there to be a socialist revolution in the developed heartlands of capitalism. That is, in the advanced industrialised nations, such as, at the time, Germany, England, France, and the United States, to name a few. A revolution which fought for workers' power, a socialist revolution, was said to be impossible in backwards, undeveloped countries, such as Russia, because capitalist development had not yet triumphed over feudal backwardness. And every socialist party in the world had some variant of this position. The essential prerequisites for socialism are only brought about by the existence of development of capitalist means of production. Capitalist development creates the abundance of production for socialism to be possible. Capitalist industry also creates the means by which socialism can be attained, the working class. What the capitalists therefore produce above all are his own gravediggers, as the famous quote goes. It follows from this that socialist revolution can't occur in a country which has not yet undergone a process of capitalist development. And the socialists who argued this position quite heavily sort of relied on a few quotations, which sort of distorted Marx and Engels' position on the question. In particular, a lot of the groups drew on a quote from Friedrich Engels' Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Germany that was published in 1851, where he said, like master, like man, the evolution of the conditions of existence for a numerous, strong, concentrated, and intelligent proletarian class goes hand in hand with the development of the conditions of an existence for a numerous, wealthy, concentrated, and powerful capitalist class. The working class movement itself never is independent, never is of an exclusively proletarian character until all the different factions of the middle class, and particularly its most progressive faction, the large manufacturers, have conquered political power and remodeled the state according to their wants. So Russia was a nation that was steeped in backwardness at the beginning of the 20th century. To give you an indication of this, there were roughly the same number of workers employed in manufacturing in the United States as there was in Russia at the time, around 5 million people. However, the value of the goods that the Russian economy produced was one-fifth the value of what the United States did. Now, this analysis led Russian Marxists to conclude that Russia was not ripe for socialist revolution. They argued that there had to be more capitalist development within Russia before the working class would be powerful enough for there to be enough material conditions for the working class to seize and hold on to power. They concluded that the coming revolution in the early 20th century would have to be one which smashed the remnants of feudalism and got rid of any fetters capitalist accumulation. This orthodoxy was accepted by almost all Marxists. Lenin, who is the leading figure of the revolutionary socialist party, the Bolsheviks, wrote in his pamphlet Two Tactics of Social Democracy in the Democratic Revolution, "At best, it may bring about a radical redistribution of land and property in favour of the peasantry, establish consistent and full democracy, including the formation of a republic, eradicate all the oppressive features of Asiatic bondage, not only in rural but also in factory life, lay the foundations for a thorough improvement in the conditions of the workers and for a rise in their standard of living, and, last but not least, carry the revolutionary conflagration into Europe. Such a victory will not yet by any means transform our bourgeois revolution into a socialist revolution. The democratic revolution will not immediately overstep the bounds of bourgeois social and economic relationships." So for Lenin, the lack of economic development in Russia resulted in a working class which was far from the majority, and that categorically ruled out the possibility of a socialist revolution within Russia at that time. However, it was clear from that statement that he did think that the successful overthrow of feudalism in Russia could provoke the working class within Europe to launch a socialist revolution. He continues to write in the same pamphlet, "The degree of Russia's economic development and objective condition and the degree of class consciousness and organization of the broad masses of the proletariat as subjective condition inseparably bound up with the objective condition make the immediate and complete emancipation of the working class impossible." But the Bolsheviks recognized that the capitalists were incapable of leading a movement for the democratic demands of overthrowing feudalism. So in the same document, Lenin writes that the bourgeoisie as a whole is incapable of waging a determined struggle against the autocracy. It fears to lose in this struggle its property, which binds it to the existing order. It fears an all too revolutionary action of the workers, who will not stop at the democratic revolution, but will aspire to a socialist revolution. My apologies, this is Trotsky in Results and Prospects, but anyway. It fears a complete break with officialdom, with the bureaucracy, whose interests are bound up by a thousand ties with the interests of the property classes. For this reason, the bourgeois struggle for liberty is notoriously timorous, inconsistent, and half-hearted. So the Bolsheviks' program was that a revolutionary alliance of all the laboring classes, the working class and the peasantry, would have to seize political power in order to develop the full gamut of democratic demands. The economic forces of society would then be unable to develop, unfettered by the feudal regime. And, you know, also that they thought that the revolution in Russia would lead to workers in Europe overthrowing the capitalist class. They're, you know, hopefully sort of bringing the conditions for socialism in Russia much, much faster. but the events of the revolution of Russia in 1905 proved that this stages theory was outdated and mistaken. So in 1905, we see massive wave of strikes sweep throughout Russia in response to the initially by the victimization of several militants, but then also in response to the massacre of hundreds of thousands of workers who were part of a peaceful procession to present a petition to the Tsar requesting reforms for the 8-hour day, end of the war with Japan, and so forth. In the aftermath of the massacre of the protesters, workers established Soviets for the first time of any revolutionary movement. Revolutionary authorities that take over control of their workplaces and also, pose the question of workers' control of society. You know, they create these Soviets, which are an alternate state power in Russia. Now, in 1905, the Soviets didn't manage to take power, but it did signpost the character of the coming revolution in Russia. And it was the generalizations of Leon Trotsky's experience in Petrograd at the time, partly by being the president of the Petrograd Soviet, that he wrote Results and Prospects, where he laid down the ideas of permanent revolution, which contradicted the ideas of a stages theory. Thank you. So the revolution in 1905 confirmed the counter-revolutionary nature of the capitalist class. The workers who took part in the general strike against the Tsar in October in 1905 gained so much confidence in their own power that a month later, the most advanced section of them, the workers in St. Petersburg, came out on strike demanding an 8-hour day. This clearly threatened the employers' pockets and they reacted immediately. The striking workers were ruthlessly locked out. In November in St. Petersburg, 72 factories with 110 workers were closed. In Moscow, 23 factories with a total of 58,000 workers were closed. And in other cities, the picture was similar. The political leadership of the liberal capitalists, the Constitutional Democrats, the leading figure of this party, called the strikes a crime against the revolution. So in Results and Prospects, Trotsky wrote that the era of capitalist-led revolution against feudal reaction had long since expired. The 1905 revolution had proved the counter-revolutionary nature of the capitalist class, as Trotsky and the Bolsheviks had expected. Trotsky identified that the capitalist class no longer had the revolutionary spirit of the great French Revolution of 1789. They trembled at the prospect of a revolutionary population seizing their property, so much so that they would rally to the old feudal order, even if it meant suffering fetters placed on their capital accumulation. Now, Trotsky writes in Results and Prospects of the need for a class to actually complete the democratic demands in the absence of the bourgeoisie being willing to take them through. So he writes, in 1848, a class was needed that would be able to take charge of events without and in spite of the bourgeoisie. A class which would not only be prepared to push the bourgeois forward by its pressure, but also at the decisive moment to throw its political corpse out of the way. So with the capitalists incapable of taking the democratic revolution to its completion, it fell to the industrial working class to lead the revolution in spite of the capitalist class. And in 1905, the working class did just that. So while liberals meekly presented demands or requests, would probably be a more accurate term, for constitutional reform, workers throughout the Russian Empire mounted a radical challenge to absolutism. Mass strikes took place in every industrial town. Workers set up barricades and engaged in street battles with the Tsar's soldiers. Trotsky goes on to argue that the Bolsheviks' program of a workers' government restricting itself to introducing democratic reforms without challenging capitalism was a utopian fantasy. So he says, the political domination of the proletariat is incompatible with its economic enslavement. No matter under what political flag the proletariat has come to power, it is obliged to take the path of socialist policy. It would be the greatest utopianism to think that the proletariat, having been raised to political domination by the internal mechanism of a bourgeois revolution, can, even if it so desires, limit its mission to the creation of a republican democratic conditions for the social domination of the bourgeoisie. So were the working class to attain political power, it could do nothing but enact socialist policy. A genuine workers' government would even in its most minimal acts impinge on the capitalist economic interests in the interests of the working class. So in the course of the 1905 revolution, the capitalists used all their economic might to crush the workers' movement through mass lockouts. If the working class had taken political power in that revolution, the only course open to it would be to expropriate the property of the capitalists who took such measures. So we see that the gulf between the democratic revolution and the socialist revolution must be bridged for the attainment of either. So this showed that Lenin's prognosis that a revolution couldn't go further than capitalist democracy in Russia was wrong. Workers demonstrated that they would seamlessly raise demands of economic emancipation alongside the struggle for democratic rights. And in doing so, workers attempted to seize power from both the feudal aristocracy and the capitalist class. There was still, however, the problem of economic backwardness in Russia. It was one thing to say that the working class would fight to attain power, but it's another to say that there would be sufficient production in the country to allow for the implementation of a socialist program. And Trotsky responds to this in explaining the peculiarities of economic development in late developing countries, and also in the need for revolutions to spread internationally. So Trotsky realized that the mistakes of the Marxist orthodoxy and most of the socialist organizations around the time laid in a fundamental misunderstanding of the process of historical development. They assumed that historical development in late developing countries would mirror that of the birthplaces of capitalism. So, for instance, a lot of the time they somewhat misused the quote by Karl Marx, which says, the country that is more developed industrially only shows to the less developed the image of its own future. However, this is clearly not the case. Late developing countries develop in the world economy dominated by the advanced countries. Countries mired in backwardness can implement the most advanced techniques in the world without needing to replicate the steps needed to development in the first place. International economic and military pressures force the pace of development, meaning that countries can leap over, telescope, or compress historic stages which took hundreds of years to complete in the first place. And so this is why, for instance, Japan could go from a largely feudal society in 1853, walled off from the rest of the world, to an industrial power by the early 1900s, a process which took roughly 400 years in Britain. Trotsky called this process combined and uneven development. And he writes in his book, The History of the Russian Revolution, which contains one of the most clear sort of explanations of this process. He says, although compelled to follow after the advanced countries, a backward country does not take things in the same order. The privilege of historic backwardness, and such a privilege exists, permits, or rather compels, the adoption of whatever is ready in advance of the specified date, skipping a whole series of intermediate stages. Savages throw away their bows and arrows for rifles all at once, without travelling the road which lay between those two weapons in the past. Now, Russia was a case study of this process. Compelled by the threat of more advanced states in Western Europe, the Russian autocracy strove to create a more modern military machine. And to do so, the state imported the most advanced industrial apparatus from the West. Trotsky argued that capitalism in all cases displays signs of unevenness in its economic development, some sections of the economy being more advanced than the others, but in the late developing countries, this unevenness is far greater. So despite the great majority of people in Russia living in rural conditions that have been unchanged for hundreds of years, in St. Petersburg, there existed the largest steelworks in the world at that time, with 12,400 workers in one complex. This meant that while the working class was only a small proportion of the population in Russia, it was concentrated in large numbers, giving the working class an economic power far greater than its proportion in society. Trotsky also understood that for the victory of socialism over capitalism, it was required there to be an international revolution. There could not be socialism in one country. So unless the working class in Russia inspired revolution in the country central to the world capitalist system, defeat was inevitable. The international capitalist class would not suffer the existence of workers' power, and so would use all of their military and economic force to crush it. And for Trotsky, this showed that the problems of the backwardness of a country like Russia could be solved if the working class revolution spread into other countries, as the forces of development in more advanced countries could come to aid the working class in a more backwards one. And he writes in Results and Prospects, "The revolution in the East will infect the Western proletariat with a revolutionary idealism and rouse a desire to speak to their enemies in Russian. Should the Russian proletariat find itself in power, if only as the result of a temporary conjuncture of circumstances in our bourgeois revolution, it will encounter the organized hostility of world reaction, and on the other hand, will find a readiness on the part of the world proletariat to give it organized support." So this raises the question of permanent revolution on a higher level, really, about the revolution being permanent internationally. Now, to fast forward a bit to 1917, because the events of 1917 proved Trotsky's theory was correct when the working class was victorious. I wouldn't drink that if I were you. I'm very sick. It's not...
Anyone else?
Lenin and the Bolsheviks adopted the theory of permanent revolution in all but name. So in April in 1917, Lenin dropped all the old formulas of the revolution being about establishing democracy that did not go beyond the limits of capitalism. He waged an argument that the Bolsheviks had to campaign for the immediate transfer of power to the Revolutionary Workers and Peasants' Councils, the Soviets. In October of 1917, the provisional government is overturned and power is taken by workers' soldiers and peasants' Soviets. The victory of the working class establishes both radical, thoroughgoing political democracy, but also establishes workers' control of the economy, proving that the working class could lead a struggle for socialism in a late developing country. Between October 1917 and 1924, workers' revolutions sweep across Europe, the revolution made permanent on an international scale. And the experience of the 1917 revolution led Trotsky to clarify one important aspect of permanent revolution, which he had somewhat neglected in his writings about 1905. For the working class to lead the revolutionary movement, it needed its own political leadership, which was independent of conservative pro-capitalist politics. That is, there needs to be a mass socialist party which can articulate a program which reflects the working class's interest in taking power. And permanent revolution was impossible without that political leadership existing. Trotsky, not seeing the need for a revolutionary party in 1905, barely mentioned the role of a revolutionary party in Results and Prospects. But in 1917, he joined the Bolsheviks, becoming a leader within the party, and he realized that the victory of the revolution was not possible without a revolutionary party to lead it. And ultimately, the lack of such revolutionary parties in the rest of Europe saw the revolutionary movement defeated. Now, unfortunately, even though permanent revolution was proved by the events of Russia of 1917, right up until today, there continues to be debates about whether the working class can or should take power in countries which are more underdeveloped. Or, other examples are countries where the struggle is about opposing imperialist domination, for example. Groups which have dropped the real Marxist tradition in favour of Stalinist politics continue to this day to argue for a revolution by stages approach. And this, for a lot of them, goes hand in hand with being apologists for the capitalist classes of third world nations or for Stalinist dictatorships that exist in the world today. Now, this tradition of politics started circa 1928, when the worker state in Russia had been overthrown by state capitalism. Stalin and his sycophants waged a relentless assault on Trotsky and permanent revolution to justify politics that were no longer informed by a desire for socialism, but for the foreign policy needs of a new capitalist state in Russia. Stalin resurrected the theory of revolution by stages to justify counter-revolutionary practices. To secure allies in the capitalist classes of other nations, he demanded that the working class subsume their demands to the interests of the capitalist class in numerous revolutions internationally, all justified with the theory that the working class must first see the completion of a capitalist stage of development in backwards nations and patiently wait, sometimes forever, for the right time for a socialist revolution. So in China in 1927, the Communist Party was told by Stalin to do coolie service, that basically means to be the servant of, the so-called progressive capitalists. This led to the wholesale massacre of workers in Shanghai at the hands of the same progressive capitalists. Again, in Spain in 1936, the Communist Party disbanded workers' councils with brutal repression, all in the name of keeping the Republican capitalists on the side, or on side. And every time the working class poses a revolutionary challenge to capitalism, the debates between permanent revolution and stagism seem to resurface. So this question has become a defining line between those in the genuine Marxist tradition of Trotskyism and the dead end of Stalinist politics. The logical corollary of the stagist approach is subordination of the working class to the interests of other propertied classes. And a perfect example of this is how the South African Communist Party uncritically tailed the middle-class African National Congress in this, the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. So in spite of there being widespread enthusiasm for socialism amongst the black working class of South Africa, the South African Communist Party vigorously opposed any working class challenge to South African capitalism before the democratic stage had been completed. The SACP demanded that workers had to drop their demands for economic emancipation so as not to scare off the black middle class and aspiring black capitalists. Joe Slovo, who was the secretary of the South African Communist Party, wrote in, I think this was the Challenge for Power, which was one of their programmatic documents in the 70s. The real question is whether the working class, by refusing to establish a common trench, helps push them right into the enemy's lap. On the other hand, by engaging them with them on common minimum platforms, the working class is able to forge a stronger opposition and also to neutralise some of the negative potential of the middle class. And this went hand in hand with their practice on the ground, which basically was a completely uncritical following of the Freedom Charter of the African National Congress. And this meant that even though it was the threat of working class revolution which saw the white ruling class in South Africa eventually abolish apartheid, it was done so on the most favourable terms for capitalism. So once Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress came to government, they embarked on a severe program of neoliberalism. Today there is 40% unemployment in South Africa, predominantly black workers. The government's own statistics conclude that the average black African household income has declined 19% between 1995 and 2000, while white household income has increased 15%. So the working class has paid a heavy price for the Stalinist politics of the South African Communist Party. And unfortunately, the influence of such Stalinist politics lingers on. So, for instance, the publishers of the Green Left Weekly in Australia hold a very similar stagist theory in opposition to permanent revolution. In fact, they have a very confused book by on it. So before I conclude, there is one clarification to permanent revolution which was made after Trotsky's death, which is important to talk about. So the intrepid listener would know that in the post-war period, a number of countries which successfully overthrew their oppression by colonial powers without there being a socialist revolution. So in Cuba, China, Ghana, India, to name a few, Egypt as well, national independence was won without there being workers' revolution, and in many cases the working class played little or no role at all. And this would seem to contradict Trotsky's theory to some extent. So the Palestinian-born British Marxist Tony Cliff expanded the theory of permanent revolution to account for this phenomenon. And he wrote, "While the conservative, cowardly nature of late developing bourgeoisie is an absolute law, the revolutionary character of the young working class is neither absolute nor inevitable." Cliff points out that in circumstances where the working class hesitates to or is incapable of leading the democratic revolution, different social strata may take over. However, this does not invalidate Trotsky's argument, as more often than not, the resulting regimes have been just as undemocratic as their predecessors, but also, as the regimes have come to power have been brutal, utterly brutal to the working class, the need for permanent revolution in these countries remains just as imperative. So I want to bring back the discussion back to the situation in Egypt today and try and point out a few things about why I think permanent revolution is so relevant for the struggle in Egypt at the moment. Because I think the only guarantee of success for the revolution in the Middle East today is to learn the lessons of permanent revolution. And it is somewhat a testament to Trotsky's theory that applies so clearly to a revolutionary struggle taking place 105 years after it was written. So Egypt today is a country that has clearly been shaped by combined and uneven development. So weaving factories in Mahalla employ the most modern means of production and combine incredible amounts of labour, over 20,000 people in one complex in some cases. But at the same time, only 43% of the 82 million people in Egypt are urbanised, and official statistics put the labour force at only 31% of the population. And Egypt has one of the largest economies in the region. So despite the working class being a minority of the population, they're concentrated together in mass numbers in some of the most advanced production methods in the world and have incredible potential power. Further to this, as I mentioned before, we've seen like a massive strike wave happening with workers raising more and more radical demands in Egypt at the moment, as they've taken the revolutionary enthusiasm of the occupation of Tahrir Square, the defiance of the state, back into their own workplaces, raising their own class demands. And I think it sort of tells you quite a lot that some of the words from the Independent Trade Unions Declaration in Egypt. Under a subheading of one of their points, they write, "It is our opinion that if this revolution does not lead to the fair distribution of wealth, it is not worth anything. Freedoms are not complete without social freedoms. The right to vote is naturally dependent on the right to a loaf of bread." So I think that clearly shows sort of the connection between the struggle for democratic rights for the working class, but then also giving enthusiasm and confidence to raise questions about their own economic emancipation as well. I think furthermore, in Egypt today, although there is a possibility for democracy, I would say, without there being a workers' revolution, I think only the working class leading the struggle can actually guarantee that the democratic demands are won. We're already seeing in Egypt a divergence in the demands or the positions broadly along class lines, where workers more and more are making up the most radical sections of the revolution, continuing to raise demands, challenging the state, trying to demand the most thoroughgoing democratic reforms, but also raising demands to raise the economic standards of workers and so forth. While at the same time, you're seeing more moderate middle-class forces raising more sort of demands for the working class to go back to work, for stability to be established, to now that we've gotten rid of Mubarak, let's let the process work itself out. I think it's only by the working class being able to articulate a program, not only that grants the most thoroughgoing democratic reforms in the country, but also combining that with the demands of the oppressed, the urban and rural poor, but also their own economic emancipation, that it can actually see a revolutionary force that could carry through both the victory of democratic demands, but also raise the prospect for the working class to struggle for power in Egypt for a revolution against capitalism. I think another sort of important sort of political point we can draw from permanent revolution that is relevant to the struggle in Egypt today is the necessity for the working class to be organised independently of other, non-working class forces. So particularly with the class divergence happening in Egypt, I think it's ever so clear that the working class needs its own political program, political leadership, and actually understands that, their interests are not unified with other sections of the revolution, that they have, different interests. And that also the middle class, particularly in Egypt, there is a history in Egypt and the rest of the region of the middle class supporting, dictatorial regimes when the working class has seemed to pose too much of a threat to the existing order. Particularly think, the way that Gamal Abdel Nasser executed the strike leaders in Egypt after he came to power, I think is a clear example of how the working class can be so easily turned on by other sections of a, revolutionary movement against imperialism, for instance, in that example, if they are seen to sort of be threatening the interests of capital too much. So the working class, it's incredibly important for them to take every instance of state violence, every instance of oppression, to put forward a program to the entire nation that not only combines, not only shows a program of the working class being able to deliver the democratic demands, but also show that the socialist demands of the working class, are possible as well. So, I think actually, I'll leave it at that point. Mm-hmm.